My name is Cecilia Davis Vasquez. I'm 25 years old. Today's date is March 12, 2020. I'm in Las Cruces, New Mexico, and I'm here with Joe, who is my new friend.
My name is Joe Smith. I'm 77 years old. Today is March 12, 2020. I'm in Las Cruces, New Mexico, and I'm being interviewed by these fine people at StoryCorps.
Yay, I'm so glad that you've come in to talk with us today. So you were in the Navy, and my first question for you is, how old were you when you joined?
I had just turned 17, so I'm a high school dropout at that time, and just got back from hitchhiking all over the United States and train hopping, and our trip ended in Sacramento, California, when the police kindly asked us to take a plane back home. And so there I joined the Navy, and my mother signed for me.
Can we back up a little bit, and can I ask you about your trip, train hopping? And
Yeah, if you'd like to.
Yeah, I'd love to hear more about that. So what made you want to do that?
Well, we left, a friend and I left from Charleston, West Virginia, shortly after Memorial Day. And so our first destination was someplace in Arkansas to pick peaches, because that's what we heard people could do. So we were 16 at the time. And so we went to Arkansas, picked peaches, got peach fuzz all over us, took bass in the peach fuzz ponds. And from there, then, we started hitchhiking different places. We weaved all over the U.S. and both of us were comfortable in jumping trains because we grew up near freight yards. And so then we started hopping trains. And so, we, you know, we got to places like Amarillo, Texas, and Denver, Colorado, Wyoming. And the neatest trip, though, was from a ride from Montana to Idaho, where a couple engineers said, hey, get in the third cab back there, stay on the floor so nobody sees you, and we'll let you off when it's safe again. So we traveled on the floor. It was cold that night, really cold. We traveled on the floor through the hills of Montana, mountains of Montana and Idaho. And then just before we got to the freight yards, he let us off at a hobo jungle. And it was hot as could be as the day got going. But anyway, it was a neat experience. And so I grew up near trains, and that really cemented it like that.
Mm-hmm. So did you meet any interesting characters on the trains when you were there besides the engineers?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You know, as when you're hopping trains, you meet all kinds of people. Unfortunately, at that time, many of them were winos. And that's what happened to us in Sacramento, is wino kept trying to get in the boxcar. He'd get in and fall out. Then he'd get back in and fall out. And so finally, after a half dozen times or so, the railroad police came along, shooed him away, and took us in.
Wow, that sounds like such an interesting experience. So, but what year was it when you joined the Navy?
1959.
Okay, all right. And you joined, you enlisted and you volunteered, right?
I did.
Yes. So you were 17. Did that mean that your parents had to sign for you?
My mother signed for me. Yeah.
What was it like for her? Do you remember what her reaction was?
Well, let's see. She signed for my brother, I think, but he had graduated from high school 4 years. You know, he was 4 years older than I was. So he had been in the Air Force. And as I recollect, she had to sign for him. So it was another signature. She was a single mother, and we had a younger sister. So it was, you know, really a great burden relief from her, too. And, it worked okay.
So tell me why you joined the Navy instead of another branch of service.
Well, let's see. I grew up during the time of getting ready for atomic warfare. And so when I grew up first in Wilmington, Delaware, we'd have blackouts. And so sometime we knew there would be an air raid on Wilmington, Delaware for sure. And that never happened. And we got to Charleston, West Virginia. We didn't have the blackout exercises, but we would always have those exercises at school where you get under the school desk and the bomb went off somewhere and somehow the school desk kept us safe. And in 1960, the Pope was supposed to read a letter from the Virgin Mary, which might tell something about the atomic warfare coming. Who knows? Still don't know. But anyway, I said, well, let's see. In the Army, I can't run from the atomic bomb. And in the Air Force, I might be able to, but we have to land sometime or another. And so I said, well, in the Navy, they could outrun that atomic bomb, perhaps. So I'm going to join with their ships.
So the atomic warfare kind of shaped how you were thinking about.
You got that exactly right.
That's very interesting.
And that's what's so neat you identify today with what kids are thinking on the environment or whatever. You know, same thing. Our thoughts are being shaped by all this stuff going on.
Yeah. So where did you actually join the Navy?
Okay. So I lived at the time in Arlington, Virginia, and I went in from Washington, D.C. That's where we started. So we got on a train and went to Great Lakes Recruit Center, and that's where I spent the rest of September, October, November.
That's where you had basic?
Yeah, basic training.
What do you remember about the first day that you arrived there at Great Lakes?
You know, I barely remember anything other than, oh, these are the uniforms you're going to wear, and bend over so I can give you another shot. So we got lots of shots, and that's pretty much all I remember that. And uniform.
Yeah. What about basic?
Okay. Basic was very good because I had a tremendous commanding officer. We call him company commander. I was in Company 450, 1959. And his name was Benjamin S. Gill. And he was an electrician's mate, chief petty officer. And in 3 weeks, he shaped me up. So from knowing better than any other human being, he's made me figure out there are other people who know more than I did. He got that fixed up real quick.
Well, you had seen a little bit of stuff running around the country, so I'm sure you felt like you had gotten a lot of experience. But 3 weeks in boot camp, that'll probably do you.
That really told me where I stood.
So what you have here a question about what do you remember about boot camp? Do you want to give me some more details or any stories?
Yeah, you know, as boot camp to me was a mixed bag of experiences because, one, I was being molded, and, two, I was learning a lot. And there were people, so I'm the youngest guy, best I could tell, and then there were people all the way up to age 25. And I said, goodness gracious, you know, these are old men, what am I doing? And so it was really, really funny. All kinds of different people. Some wanted to be in the military. Some didn't want to be in the military. And so what a bag of experiences. But what I think I liked the most was being able to take the train down to Chicago. I think we did it twice. Got to go down to Chicago. I'd never been to Chicago before. Got to see what Chicago like. And then another little town in Illinois called Waukegan, as I recollect. And always being tempted for tattoos, but I never got a tattoo.
What were you tempted by? Which one did you want to get?
Oh, you know, there are all kinds of neat little tattoos. Who knew? But the Navy advised against them, so I still don't have tattoos.
My grandfather got a tattoo in the Navy, actually.
Yeah, a lot of guys.
Yeah. Tell me what you remember about Chicago.
Well, Chicago, I just remember that there were a lot of places where, because I was 17, I couldn't go into bars where everybody else was going.
Oh, dang.
So I roamed the streets, which I'm good at doing, roaming the streets, always looking for a place to sleep on the street. And I kept doing that until I was in about 5 years ago now. I finally broke that habit. Always looking for a place to sleep on the streets and always looking for escapes. When I walk in anywhere, I try to figure out how can I get out of here quick.
Absolutely.
In any direction.
Yeah. So tell me a little bit more about Gill, your commanding officer.
Yes, Chief Petty Officer Gill. So mm-hmm. He was a World War II Japanese prisoner of war. His submarine, the USS Perch, had been sunk. And there were 54 crew members, and all but four of them survived the prisoner of war camps. So most of them, after they were questioned at this illegal torture camp, they went to the mines to work, and so were liberated in 1945. And he, as I understand, when he came back was, you know, less than 90 pounds. So just a ghost of what he had been.
Mm-hmm.
And so in boot camp, that was important because he could not understand why anybody would not want to take a shower every single day and twice if it was offered. And so there were some people that didn't think shower or shaves were right things to do. But he got that corrected real fast, too. So he taught us to be appreciative of the luxuries that we have now that we take for granted. He says, because you might not always have them.
Right. So he was a big impact on you.
Big impact. Huge impact. And then I learned much later, you know, about more of the things that he did after he retired. And but I never met up with him in Michigan. I sure wish I would have known he was there. Would have made a special effort to go meet him.
So you have a question here about whether or not you knew that he had been a Japanese prisoner of war after the sinking of the USS Perch. You just talked about that a little bit. So let me know about your first duty station.
So my first duty station, lo and behold, here I am trying to outrun the atomic bomb. I end up on an Air Force base.
Oh, my gosh.
And the McGuire Air Force Base, Wrightsville, New Jersey, near Trenton, New Jersey. You probably know it.
I don't know it. I didn't spend much time in New Jersey, to be honest with you.
Okay. And so anyway, it was right next to Fort Dix, and the Navy was in a part of it called VR-6, heavier than Air 6, so part of the Military Air Transport Service. And so I went there. That was my first duty station. And the barracks were really nice. They were all cinder block barracks, and you had two people in a room, far different from what boot camp was,
right?
Far different what the ships would be. And so it was a really neat base as far as I'm concerned. But when I got there, I knew absolutely how to do nothing. Zip. Such that the boatswain mate said nasty words about my painting and didn't want me to paint anymore. And he kept giving me extra duty when I would sweep the hangars because the broom head would keep falling off for me. He thought I was playing around, so he gave me extra duty. And it wasn't until my daughter was in the first grade that I learned that broom handles fall out because I'm left-handed.
Oh,
my
gosh.
And it untwists the handle. Didn't learn that until I was, 35 years old, I guess. And so it's really amazing. So he gave me that extra duty all the time. He said, we got to get you something else to do. And he found out I could type. So he got me into the legal office, got me started on my GED diploma. And legal office worked out okay, but, you know, then you had onion skins. So you had one nice piece of paper, and then you had all these onion skins, very, very thin pieces of paper. If you made one mistake, you had to erase all seven. And I said, no, I don't want to do this very long. And so I got into the dispersing office, and that's where they calculated payroll.
Okay.
And I learned enough there. They liked it because I could use my left hand to operate the machines and my right hand I was able to write with. And so they thought I could work pretty quick. And they taught me enough so that by the time I got on board ship that I was able to be a dispersing clerk.
So I want to ask you a little bit about how you became. Well, you just talked a little bit about that. What ships did you serve on, and can you describe, like, the first one?
Yeah, the first ship was the USS Hank, DD-702, out of Norfolk, Virginia. It was an old World War II ship. I say old. It wasn't all that old at that time. So really wasn't all that old at that time at all. But so I went on board the USS Hank, and once again, because I didn't know how to do anything, they had me assigned to the deck, and the boatswain mate real quick found out I couldn't do anything. Painting was useless, broom heads fall off, and what am I going to do with you? And he had another deckhand that had transferred to the dispersing office, and that deckhand did not want to be in the dispersing office, so thankfully we were able to trade.
Yeah.
The boatswain mate got a trade set off, so I was able to get in the dispersing office, and I thought that was fantastic. What a blessing that was. But my first payroll I did, there was, about 300 of us on board, and I had 297 mistakes. And not a good thing to do with a bunch of sailors that needed money Friday night. So that taught me all about not making mistakes.
Well, you make one big one and then you don't want to do it again. Can you tell me a little bit of, can you describe the boat, that first boat, like what it looked like and what your quarters were
long,
like?
It was long and gray. And you can look up all the specs for the USS Hank, which I have not done for this. But it was, and so here's the way it was kind of divided up. In the fore, down below deck, in the front of the ship, is where we would go down for, where I bunked. So there must have been, oh, I don't know, 60, 70, 80, 90 of us in that sleeping area. And we slept four high. And my bunk was next to the bulkhead and on the lowest bunk. And right below me then were four lockers. So I always had to have my bunk up a little bit in case somebody came along once I got in bed. So I cranked it up a little bit on the chain. I put a couple links up on the chain. People could still get in the locker. And but it turned out to be nice because one time we were in the Mediterranean, this tidal wave came through, and it was big waves. We were like a submarine all of a sudden. And so I just cranked up my bunk, slept up against the bulkhead, and I think I stayed in there for 24 hours without coming out. Pretty nice, turned out.
What was it like for you that first time you had like a super scary storm or waves that were like bigger than you'd ever seen before?
Yeah, is just go down and be glad I didn't have to do any payroll work. I wanted to describe also is for a young guy like me is in boot camp, of course, we got used to using the showers together and everything else. But on the USS Hank, sometimes, you know, you really had to line up and one person be in the shower, one person be out soaping down, one person jump in the shower, another, you know. So when I got to college, I was able to tell the landlord I knew how to do that.
That's funny. So what was the second ship you served on?
It was the USS Leahy, and it was commissioned the year before I got on board. I got on board in 1963. It was commissioned in 1962. And in 1963, we were doing the shakedown cruises. So I established a payroll office and had a great ensign that also helped establish the payroll office. And I forgot to tell you, on the USS Hank is the ensign dispersing officer. He helped me do my college entrance boards. So when a lot of people were having fun in Kingston and other nice places, I was studying for my college entrance boards. And then during the Guantanamo missile crisis, I still got to study for my boards, even though we were at Guantanamo at the time, the Cuban missile crisis. So, okay, back to the USS Leahy. It was a guided missile destroyer. And after I was discharged, and then in 1964, it went on its first cruise to the Mediterranean. But later it was decommissioned as a DLG and commissioned as a CG, a cruiser. So now that's how they know it, a CG-16. You don't find DLG-16 anymore. And it's been scrapped in Houston about 6 years ago. So it was a real neat ship, though. Guided missile. And a helicopter landing pad eventually got on it, worked sometimes. Wow. So our big thing was the elevator. Didn't work very good. It was top heavy.
Are there any officers or other people that you remember in a special way?
Yeah, it was Ensign Patterson on the USS Hank. A very special guy because he really encouraged me to do my college entrance boards. Told me what to study, how to study, where to study, when to study. So kept me on task.
Do you feel like that, did you end up following that advice? Was he right?
I did. Oh, I did. Oh, yes. Yeah, I sure did. Yeah, you know, like I said, it took 3 weeks to understand. Look. he helped me a lot and kept me on task. And so then, of course, after the Navy, I lost track of him. But about 10 years ago, I think about the time I was retiring, I found him and talked to him by phone, and he was still in the service. And I think at the time he was at Quantico, perhaps in Virginia, if I remember correctly.
Did you have a third ship you were on?
No, not the third ship. But my second ship, I had another officer, and that was Ensign Jeremiah M. Sullivan. There's a lot of Jeremiah Sullivans in the world. Never knew that before. And but there are a ton of them. So he's Jeremiah M. Sullivan. He played football for Princeton. And he helped me write my letters to colleges as to why they think, why I thought I should be admitted and have a great scholarship too. And so he helped me with all those letters, with words I'd never heard of before. Financial straits. Who ever heard of those words? Have you ever heard of those words before? So he said, yeah, you know, it's difficult financial straits. You know, so he really helped me a lot.
That's very sweet. I wanted to go back a little bit and ask you about any stories you might have about traveling. You said you went to the Mediterranean.
Yeah.
Do you have any, like, fond memories of seeing the ocean?
I learned how to ski in Italy on the backside of the Alps, on the Italian side of the Alps. And that was so neat because, you know, the way to learn is you started at the top and it took you all day to come down. You stopped and had lunch in between. And even one day we stopped and stayed overnight and continued the next day. So that was a lot of fun. And enjoyed that a lot. And then another place, it was Genoa, Italy. We called it Leghorn, I think. And an Italian family had us in for Christmas dinners. And that was very, very nice, like that. So learned an awful lot by doing those things. And what was neat, though, is one of the things I remember so special was the Parthenon in Greece. So you look at that in school and it means nothing, but you're there, it means a lot. And so like hitchhiking, I learned so much hitchhiking, and I learned so much by roaming the Mediterranean with the Navy that, school tried to teach you, but didn't work for me.
It didn't sink in as much.
Didn't sink in at all.
Yeah. What do you you said it meant a lot for you when you were there. Like, what did you feel when you saw the Parthenon?
Oh, wow. That's all I can say. Wow, look at this big place. And, it wasn't until later that I understood, and I guess that was in college, I started understanding how those pillars are made in such a way that they're not really the same size, but they just look the same size. And so it's just fantastic to learn, you know, what those people, which we call ancients, which we think might be uneducated or whatever, I don't know, their technology, in my opinion, is as great as our technology today, using what they could, what they had, in order to accomplish what they did. And, you know, Italy, the same thing, all the viaducts, all everything running around with the water going where it ought to go, and been like that forever.
So where were you during the Cuban Missile Crisis?
Okay, so in the Cuban Missile Crisis, we were on our way back from the Mediterranean. And this is neat because on the way back from the Mediterranean, and I was supposed to be assigned to another ship. And but then President Kennedy said, wait a minute. And so when he says, I'm sending our ships to the Straits, we were already in the Straits. And so we did the blockade, chased a Russian submarine around. It was really the only time that the battle station was live, and the first time I heard fire and then ceasefire immediately, and there was a plane coming in that didn't have its IFF on, and we were going to shoot it down, and then the gunnery officer started ceasefire, I guess, right away. That's the only time I had that, and it was so different. The Guantanamo was so different because it used to be you could get off and you go to the beer hall and you'd have real beer. Okay, so now you got to remember, I was a young piece in a lot of places. You couldn't drink at my age. But at the beer hall, could always drink. But this time when you went back for the Cuban Missile Crisis, all of a sudden all these Marines were running around the base with loaded guns. That made me feel uncomfortable. Because I knew too many of them. And then the grassy areas that we played around with had become pillboxes, landmines, and the whole works. And the beer hall became 1% beer. And a whole different experience than when we were there before the Cuban Missile Crisis.
I see.
Can't even imagine what it's like today. being a penitentiary, what have you.
Tell me a little bit more. You said you were chasing around a Russian submarine.
Yeah.
What was that like for, like?
Well, you know, as you don't know what's going on there, and that's where your radio men become good friends, because they hear what's going on. And so they tell you once in a while. But yeah, so we apparently there is a Russian submarine that people figure that shouldn't be there. So we chased it around a little bit, dropped some depth charges, and as best I can recollect, it surfaced and nothing more happened from there.
So do you have there's a question here about whether or not you have any special memories about it. Do you want to share any details or memories about it?
About which part? Now, let's see. So
the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Oh, yeah.
We talked about it a little bit, but I feel like you might have a story
Cuban
to tell.
Cuban Missile Crisis. So coming back, I was supposed to get transferred, and I would have gone to Charleston, South Carolina. The missile crisis delayed it, so we didn't get back in port until November. And so my orders got changed, and I was had to go to the USS Leahy, and that was in Boston, Massachusetts. So I hitchhiked from Norfolk, and I stopped in Charleston, West Virginia, where what I consider home. Stopped in Charleston, West Virginia, and a friend of mine had a date, and her roommate was my blind date. So I met my blind date, and so then we got married. And that's going to be 54 years ago in May. But so I met her, and then I don't think that would have ever happened if I had gone to Charleston, South Carolina. So anyway, met her there, and then when I went to Boston, I would hike back frequently to Charleston, West Virginia to be with her. So I'd hitchhike from Boston, Massachusetts. I'd get up Friday, do my duties, leave, and then get back Monday morning by hitchhiking. If I was lucky, one time I was late, and have to stay awake until Monday night, and then I'd hit the sack. So that was always a lot of fun. So that was very memorable, dating my wife from Boston, Massachusetts, and Charleston, West Virginia.
Tell me about that date.
Oh,
so you walk in and
so there is Jane. And guess what movie we went to see? Whatever Happened to Baby Jane? I don't know if you know that movie.
No, but that's
okay.
Funny.
You'll have to look it up.
I will.
And so it's a scary movie. So we went to that. We went to that movie, and so it was just a tremendous, tremendous date. Good way to get to know somebody.
With a scary movie.
Yeah, it was a scary movie.
What about your friend and his date? How did they end up?
Well, let's see. They ended up getting married. And then after some time, they got divorced, unfortunately. Unfortunately.
That's okay. It happens.
Yeah.
All right. So when did you leave the service?
So I left the service when I turned 21. Today, so the way it works is when you join the Navy at 17, they put you on a kiddie cruise. So anytime you're 17, you can be, just one day from 18, and you get out on the day before your 21st birthday. So that's when I was discharged. And after I was discharged, I went to Charleston. I went to school there at what's Morris Harvey College, now known as the University of Charleston, West Virginia. And so I dated during that, and then I graduated one day in May of 1966. And we took a day off because it was Memorial Day and got married the next day. That was Tuesday. And then the next day, we went to Michigan to go to Michigan State University to work on my graduate degree.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So I guess my next question for you is, in between when you met your wife and when you got married, were you, like, dating each other long distance or?
Well, we were dating. So from Boston to Charleston,
right.
Yeah, that time. Mm-hmm. So let's say that's from December until September.
Got it.
December of 1962 to September of 1963. So if you want to call that long, so that's a lot of hitchhiking. And after that, she was going to radiology technology school, and I was going to, so we lived, 2 miles apart. I didn't have a car, so I would walk to her place, and we'd walk all the way around, 5 miles or so, and then I'd drop her off, and I'd come back to my place.
A lot of walking.
And, yeah, a lot of walking. And so we dated all that time. And let's see, I didn't get a car until just before I graduated. And that's kind of neat because I was getting worried about how am I going to get from here to here and get married and all that and not have a car. And so we got a car, but before I could do that, I had to learn to drive and get a driver's license. So I called my aunt who lived up on the hillside, and I said, hey, will you take me to South Charleston to get my driver's license? She said, sure. Can you drive? And I said, yeah, I'll drive. And so she came down and picked me up, let me drive to South Charleston. I passed my test, and then I came back and showed her I got my temporary license. And she says, that's okay, I'll drive home. I thought you said you could drive. And I said, no, I said I would drive. And that was the first time I'd driven, so, and I was lucky.
That's so funny. So what did you do with your career after the service?
Okay, so after the service, I went to school, and had great landlord, Mr. and Mrs. Scales. They had four or five boys, and then three, four, five students at Morris Harvey College, and three of us shared a room, and that worked really great. And she was the one that said, boys, you got to take the shower all at the same time. One get wet, one get soapy, one rinse off. And she didn't want that water to be running very long at all. After 7 minutes, she was pounding on the door. Like, come on, it's time enough now. She was a wonderful landlord. She and her husband and all the boys were just fantastic. So then after that, I went to Michigan State University. I did my graduate work. But in between, I worked in a hospital for a while at Hayes Green Beach Hospital in Charlotte. Yeah, Charlotte, not Charlotte. Charlotte, not Charlotte. Charlotte, Michigan. And worked there for almost 4 years. Then did my graduate work at Michigan State University. And then after that, I eventually got into banking. Mm-hmm. So I stayed in banking. Started in accounting, and from there got into all kinds of things.
Yeah. But you had experience, obviously, with all those numbers, having done that in the Navy.
Yeah, I had experience all those numbers, but again, had a great boss, great mentor, Bill Connor, at my first bank, American Bank and Trust. He wanted me to reconcile some bank accounts, and I was reconciling the accounts, and then I told him, look, Bill, this is off 10 cents, okay, if I just write it off. He said, no, don't worry about it. Just go back and find every penny. And I said, well, it's only a dime. He said, go back and find it. And so, I don't know, 7 or 8 hours later, I found it. And it was a good thing because it was, you know, two tickets that involved $1 million each, one to one account and one to another account. And had I not done that, as some people would be very angry.
Mm. Tell me about your dog. When did you get your dog and what's its
name?
Well,
let's see. We've had dogs ever since we're married practically, cats or dogs or both. And but this dog is kind of special. But anyway, I had different dogs, and I'll tell you, our first toy poodle was Lily, L-I-L-Y. And we had her while we were in Michigan. And then I was transferred to Wisconsin for a couple years. And she got sick, you know, as I had been in on the, yeah, during the New York attack. I had just left Washington, D.C. the day before to visit my sister. And anyway, then our dog got sick and was very, 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 very sick. And shortly after that, I had a AFib, and they did all kinds of, they got my heart started again on the right beat. But then they said, okay, we think that this is just a singles because of the terror attack and because your dog was sick. Probably the dog was sick was the biggest contributor. And so Lily died. And we got another toy poodle, a little black one called Poquito, and had him for a long, 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 long time. And then when he died, I traveled to Cleveland to get this dog. And the lady said, no, you can't travel by yourself with a dog. And I said, sure I can. And so I stayed there in Cleveland for 3 days to bond with her. And then by the time I got home, I had, you know, we had gone to restaurants and churches and everything, 4 days to drive home. And she was my dog. She walked in the house, looked at my wife and said, "You didn't tell me you were bringing me home to another woman. I'm a single guy. No. And so anyway, it took her 3 weeks to warm up to my wife. And her dog has become mine.
That's very sweet. Do you have anything else you want to share with me before we end?
Well, I want to thank you guys for doing this.
Absolutely.
I think it's fantastic.
My pleasure.
And I hope that somehow in the years to come, some of this information might be valuable to somebody. But most important is want to share is I can only be the person I am today because of the people that I've met, run in, and cared about me and set me on the right path. Time and time and time again.
That's very special.
It's kind of like the biblical scripture, if you remember, is there were four people that carried a paralytic to Jesus. And they carried the paralytic up on the roof, dropped him down below, and Jesus told him to get up and walk onto his mat. Well, it was those four paralytics that did all the believing. Those are the people that believed in the paralytic and believed that there could be something happen to this guy. And I feel like I've run into a lot of those people that carried me around and got me in the right place.
Thank you.
Yeah.